Good evening and welcome to our study for February 17th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 21:36 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green. I am Ward Green, in fact, and I'm pleased to be with you again today for our study of several things, some of the reading of which in the Bible will be too much to cover today in its entirety, but I do encourage you to, if you so desire, finish the reading that we do begin in the chapters of our study today, and also in the study chapters that we've had in previous days, but which we have not been able to fully cover. You may also complete or conclude those readings on your own, if you so choose. Now, the Rhine Papyrus proves that Moses moved south. Remarkably, in the Crucible of Credible Creed article, and in the chapter on Moses, I don't talk about Nubia. So we're going to have to see what we have here in the upcoming material that we have in the Crucible article regarding that. But it's fascinating that in that chapter regarding Moses, chapter 10 of the Crucible article, which is part 2, we see here the actual problem of the 46 years that we discovered were missing from the chronology in the Assyrian chronology. It is proven by the generation lengths, which average less than the number 27 or 28 years per generation, by a significant number of 4 years. For 9 generations, it's 4 years less than the average generation, which proves that there is time missing from the chronology. And it's during this time, 935 to 727, that's too short of a time period for 9 generations, because it only averages 23 years per generation. So that 46 years that is missing, when we average it and add it back in, we get 981 instead of 935, which is 46 years higher, and we get an average of 28.2 years per generation for those 9 generations, which is remarkable. And there are many other details to how the chronology is slightly and significantly altered for some of the other kings. For example, Ashurnasirpal II has a 46-year discrepancy, and all of that is talked about in and how they're resolved in the inset, table 4, which is contained within chapter 10 of this Crucible article, or C-cubed article, which we're studying today. And note also in chapter 10, paragraph 2, that the letters K and R, which also stand for key reason, it also applies, the letter K and the letter C are interchangeable as far as their hard consonant sound goes. Crucible also has these letters KR or CR at the beginning, and that can refer to the same idea as the word car or carriage, because it has CR. And chronology and creed also have CR. But it's interesting that the crucible may also be regarded as, well, you can let me know, I guess, if it's interesting to you. But the carriage idea is another idea of both the crucible. It's the carriage that carries us in our investigation of the history. It's guiding us and carrying us. So the relevance, the Rhine Papyrus proves that Moses moved south for the events described as quote-unquote entering of the city Heliopolis, which means the southern pharaoh invaded and defeated the northern pharaoh's city of Heliopolis. Little children, the relevance is that the marriage of Herod was the daughter of Apophis. Don't know if we've covered that yet. I think we did. And her marriage to the Pharaoh of the South is proven by the deeds of Moses in the South, with the fact that Moses has a tradition about him that talks about his battle with the Nubians in the south. So he must have been associated with the southern kingdom of Egypt at that time. It would make logical sense. It's the only way it makes sense. Now, it makes complete sense. And Moses was an adopted grandson of Apophis, because his adoptive mother was Heret, the daughter of Apophis. So when she married a king in the south, and this is proven because there was found in one of the graves of the southern kings an artifact that was associated with Heret, this daughter of Apophis. So there was some connection. That's the proof. Well, that's the tangible proof, but there's other, as we see here, there's evidence, because Moses was in the wars of the south as a fighter for the south. But he became an adopted son of a southern pharaoh because his mother married a southern pharaoh, is what we believe. It's from the evidence. And not everyone believes this. It's like with the fact that I cured arthritis. Not everyone believes that you can cure arthritis. You can't go to a doctor and say, cure my arthritis. You won't be able to do it. These things are not common knowledge. I'm not saying that. I'm saying these are what is faithful and true. These are what the facts that are faithful and true. Whether you choose to believe them is up to you. And he became an adopted son. Isn't that fascinating? An adopted son of a southern pharaoh or prince of the south is what I'm saying. The purified result is that Apophis is the pharaoh for the early days of Moses in the north. We know that Apophis was the pharaoh of the north. And we believe it's the same time as Moses at the time of his birth. It fits perfectly with our chronology, so it makes perfect sense. And Amos the first, the pharaoh of the south. During those years, Moses was, that is, Amos was the pharaoh of the south. During those years, Moses was 22 to 39 years old, which is the years when a man typically becomes involved in fighting, because 20 years old was the minimum age for the Hebrews, for example, for a man of war. A young man doesn't reach his full strength until the age of 20. So that's why warfare begins for young men when they reach 20 years old. Not that we're involved in warfare as Jehovah's people nowadays. We're not. Not at all. In fact, Jehovah's people have suffered greatly because of their refusal to participate in war at any cost. Now, Proverbs chapter 22, little children, verse 4 is today's proverb. The result of humility and the fear of Jehovah is riches and glory and life. Humility and the fear of Jehovah. Humility and the fear of Jehovah. See, not just humility. We fear Jehovah, we don't fear men. Remember the scripture? It might be Psalm 46, I forget. It says, in God we trust. In God we trust. But why does it say that? It means also that in men we do not trust. That's what it means. Fear of Jehovah, but we don't fear men. No matter what they might do to us, that's important. We don't fear men. They're not reliable either. They can change their minds. Jehovah is reliable, and we fear Jehovah. And the result of humility and the fear of Jehovah is three things: riches and glory and life. I hope you enjoyed that. That was our scripture for the day, 1 Chronicles chapter 7. We are going to have a time today. We're not going to cover this entirely at all. There's a lot of information in 1 Chronicles. We're not going to be able to read it, but like I said before, you're more than welcome to read this on your own. And in fact, you ought to do it at least one time in your lifetime, to read the whole Bible. Now, the sons of Issachar were Tola and Puah, Jashub and Shimron, 4. And by the way, once you've read the whole Bible once, you're probably not going to be complaining about the idea of reading it again, based on the benefit you gained from the first reading. And the sons of Tola were Azi and Rephaiah and Jeriel and Jamai and Ibsam and Shemuel, heads of the house of their forefathers. Of Tola there were valiant mighty men by their descendants. Their number in the days of David was 22,600. And as the commentary of Adam Clark mentions, we don't know whether this was the number obtained by David's servant, Joab. Was it Joab? I forgot the name of the gentleman now. The assistant of David, Joab, isn't it? Who is it? Oh, he didn't. Yeah, Joab. There it is. Whether this was the number returned by Joab and his assistants when they made that census of the people, with which God was so much displeased, we know not. Adam Clark writes, but the sons of Uzzi were Izrahiah, and the sons of Izrahiah were Michael, and Obadiah, and Joel, Ishiah, five, all of them being heads. We're missing one of the five, are we? Yeah, we're missing one of the five in the list. And with them, by their descendants, according to the house of their forefathers, there were troops of the army for war, 36,000. For they had many wives and sons, and their brothers of all the families of Issachar were valiant, mighty men, 87,000 by the genealogical enrollment of them all. The sons of Benjamin were Bela and Beker and Jediael, three, and the sons of Bela were Ezbon and Uzzi and Uzziel and Jeremoth and Iri, five, heads of the house of their forefathers, valiant, mighty men, and their genealogical enrollment was 22,034. And it goes on. We're not going to read all that. Let's go down. Let's go down to verse 12. And the Shuppim and the Huppim were the sons of Ir. The Hushim were the sons of Aher. The sons of Naphtali were Jaziel and Guni and Jezer and Shalom, the sons of Bilhah. The sons of Manasseh were Azrael, whom his Syrian concubine bore. She bore Machir, the father of Gilead, and Machir himself took a wife for Huppim and for Shuppim. And the name of his sister was Maacah. And the name of the second was Zelophehad. We've learned about him already. But Zelophehad came to have daughters, not sons. In time, Maacah, Maker's wife, bore a son and called his name Peresh. And the name of his brother was Sheresh, and his sons were Ulam and Rekem. And we'll skip on. These were the sons of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, it says in verse 17. But we need to, it all has to be read in context, because you can't just jump into one verse. We don't know whether that particular reference refers to the previous list or the list that follows. We have to read the whole thing to get the sense of it. And the sons of Ephraim, verse 20, were Shuthelah and Bered his son, and Tahath his son, and Eliada his son, and Tahath his son, and Zabad his son, and Shuthelah his son, and Ezer and Elead. Verse 21, that is. And the men of Gath that were born in the land killed them, because they came down to take their livestock. And Ephraim, their father, carried on mourning for many days. And his brothers kept coming in to comfort him. Afterward, he had relations with his wife, so that she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. But he called his name Beriah, because it was with calamity that she happened to be in his house. And his daughter was Sheerah. And she got to build Beth-horon, the lower and the upper, and Uzen Sheerah. And there was Repha his son, Reshef, and Tela his son, and Tahan his son, Ladan his son, Amihud his son, Elishama his son, Nun his son, Jehoshua his son. We know the name of Joshua, the son of Nun. Do we not? Joshua the son of Nun is, of course, the Israelite who led Israel into the promised land, who was the assistant also of the minister too, as well, Moses. Joshua the son of Nun. So these were descendants of Ephraim, as we saw from verse 22. click on noon, and it's also spelled N-O-N in the Masoretic text, by the way, instead of N-U-N. Now, the vowels, of course, were only added by the Masoretes. They didn't, or by the scribes who came later, around, 1,000 years after Christ, is when these scribes added the vowels to the original text. So there were no vowels originally in the Hebrew. And in fact, I believe I've written somewhere else that 80% of all of ancient Hebrew is made up of the Bible. The Bible comprises about 80% of all that we know of all of known ancient Hebrew. So the Bible itself is like a code book where we have to decipher what it means from basically itself alone, because there's no other real source of ancient Hebrew to compare with to understand what the words mean. That makes it a very big task to decipher what the Bible means and translate it properly. But there is, of course, a modern Hebrew language, and there are similarities between the ancient and the modern languages of Hebrew, of which I'm not a student and I haven't studied these things in detail. I am a student, though, of the Bible text greatly, so I do know something about that. And their possession in verse 28 and their dwelling places were Bethel and its dependent towns to the east, Naaran, and to the west, Gezer, and its dependent towns in Shechem, and its dependent towns clear to Gaza, talking about Ephraim, and by the side of the sons of Manasseh, Bethshean, and its dependent towns, because from that we see Ephraim lived alongside the sons of Manasseh, because Ephraim was the brother also of Manasseh, and they were both sons of Joseph. In these the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, dwelt, it says in verse 29. And the sons of Asher were Imnah and Ishva and Ishvi and Beriah, and Sarah was their sister. Time is really going to fly if we're not careful here, but we're still good. And the sons of Beriah were Heber and Malchiel, who was the father of Birzeith. As for Heber, he became father to Japhlet and Shomer and Hotham, and to Shua their sister. And the sons of Japhlet were Pesach and Bimhal and Ashvath. These were the sons of Japhlet. And the sons of Shemer were Ehi and Roga, Jehubba and Aram. And there's a long list, and all at, let's keep going. Let's jump down to verse 40. All these were the sons of Asher, heads of the house of the forefathers, select, valiant, mighty men, heads of the chieftains, and their genealogical enrollment was in the army in the war. As we mentioned today already, warfare is no longer one of the pursuits of Jehovah's people, but it was in those days. Their number was 26,000 men, it said at the end of verse 40, and that's the end of 1 Chronicles chapter 7, our study for today, little children. We saw very important chronological information in the previous chapter 6 of Chronicles, verse 33, that shows the 22 generations from Jacob, or Israel, down to Heman, who was a singer in the days of King David. And that, along with other evidence, has given us reason to believe that the time period, and also we have other evidence of. There's so much evidence it's in the articles. I haven't got it all in my head, unfortunately. When I was writing my articles, I was needing to research my articles all the time, constantly. I had to continue to refer back to previous articles, and there were probably not too many times when I missed that I'd already written about something. But now I'm going to be challenge to get back into studying my own articles. Hopefully my own study and my own explanations will improve greatly as we continue on, but the Crucible article itself contains a great many remarkable things to explain this. I'm trying to think, what was the name of the article? I think it was The Crucible. Let's go and see. The Crucible Part 2. Let's check Part 2 to see if it's in this article. Let's see, Joshua. Chapter 11. It might be in this chapter. Yeah, might be here. Yeah, 36 years per generation, Jacob to Joshua. You see this? So even in chapter 11 of the Crucible article, which is part 2 of the Crucible, chapter 11 is, 10, 11, and 12 are the chapters in part 2 of the Crucible. We see there that it's a reasonable thing to have a 36-year average generation from Jacob to Joshua. But that's only when we give our own chronology for the birth of Jacob, which is BCE 2044. BCE 2044 as the birth of Jacob. That's what renders or allows this final result. And it's a good result. Right. Right. And this was adjusted. This number of generations from Rahab to the time of King David, rather than four generations, 10 generations is what allowed that calculation to work out that way. Otherwise, the generation length would be far much, far greater. But all of our results that we've obtained have been undertaken with great pains in terms of the amount of pain and also the number of the pains taken to arrive at these results. This wasn't done lightly. Let's see. Well, we know we have the 22 generations from the Bible, 1 Chronicles 6:33 and onward, for the time of Jacob or Israel down to King David's time. So that's the thing that really anchors this idea and proves that there are missing generations in the other chronologies. At least it seems very reasonable to believe that. It's only possible to believe, you know, the most reasonable things. Generally, it's, you know, of course we believe miracles, but we don't believe in very, it's not common for generations to be less than, or like, it is, sometimes it is, does happen that generations are much shorter and they're 20 years per generation in certain extraordinary cases. It doesn't happen on average, generally, though. 27 years per generation, or more. If it's firstborn sons, it's 27, but not usually less than that. But here we have 43 years per generation because of this calculation of 22 generations. Right? And then wow, okay. But from that same point, we have, how do we get that? Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, we have to reread the article and figure out what I did precisely. You can see it's quite detailed here. It's quite a lot of information. Let's go on. So we can't cover it all, unfortunately, but there's a lot of thought that's been put into it already by many people, myself included, but I'm saying there's no other chronology that is like ours. This genealogy, the genealogy that was under my authorship has been the only thing of its kind. There's nothing else to compare. It includes astronomical analyses of eclipses and all sorts of things that align with the chronologies of different nations even. And there's an important astronomical element to the chronology, therefore, also. But the other thing is, there are many different nations that have chronologies, and they are all accounted for in our chronology. We've accounted for the, I think it's written about, you'll see it in chapter 10 of Crucible, the chapter called Moses of this article, Crucible, that we're reading now. It's in that chapter. Talks about the Hittite nation also has their chronology does not align unless we are careful, and that all aligns with the Egyptians, the Assyrians, Babylonians, and God's people. That all the chronologies are aligned in our chronology, which doesn't happen in other chronologies, and you won't be able to enjoy that if you adopt another chronology. That's why it's so important that we strive to understand the true chronology, the one that fits the best for all national chronologies, which is what the genealogy does. And it's based in many things, including astronomical studies of eclipses, the moon. It goes on and on and on. The star Sothis, the list goes on and on and on of all the things covered. Daniel, today's chapter is chapter 8. We just have enough time. In the third year of the kingship of Belshazzar the king, Daniel writes, there was a vision that appeared to me, even me, Daniel, after the one appearing to me at the start. And I began to see in the vision, and it came about while I was seeing that I was in Shushan the castle, which is in Elam, the jurisdictional district. And I proceeded to see in the vision, and I myself happened to be by the watercourse of Ulai. You know what? Yeah, I also have to say, I'm late again today, little ones, so you might be watching this tomorrow, but the reason I'm late is because I started slightly earlier to sleep, but I slept slightly longer than the number of hours of yesterday. So, yeah, I think I'm back on the same time as I was on yesterday, roughly, but I got a little more sleep last night. I can't believe my level of health. It's really, really remarkable how much you can actually cure and reverse diseases, and you can reverse aging by the right application of supplements to your food. When I raised my eyes, then I saw, and look, a ram standing before the watercourse, and it had two horns, and the two horns were tall, but the one was taller than the other, and the taller was the one that came up afterward. I saw the ram making thrusts to the west and to the north and to the south, and no wild beasts kept standing before it. And there was no one doing any delivering out of its hand, and it did according to its will, and etc. Okay, so he considered, and then there was a male of the goats coming from the sunset, and it wasn't touching the earth, even though it was upon the surface. And as regards this he-goat, there was a conspicuous horn between its eyes. You might call it like a unigoat or something. I don't know. And it was coming in close touch with the ram, and it struck down the ram and broke its two horns. And the male of the goats put on great airs to an extreme, but as soon as it became mighty, the great horn was broken. And there proceeded to come up conspicuously four instead of it toward the four winds of the heavens. And we know that Alexander the Great's kingdom had this property, that this was long after Daniel's time, hundreds of years after Daniel's time. There were four generals of Alexander the Great, and who succeeded him, so that his kingdom was divided into four after him. And that's why this can be identified, but we don't even need to identify it in that manner, because the remarkable thing is, it's identified in the same chapter. And another horn came forth, in this same chapter, we'll see, but another horn came forth, out of one of these other horns. And all of these things have been talked about by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. But in the Bible itself, the Holy One spoke in this chapter. And then, it's remarkable because it talks about the transgression causing desolation in verse 13. To make both the holy place and the army things to trample on. And we know the Roman army came and destroyed Jerusalem's temple in 70 CE. They came and trampled on the holy place. So that was a fulfillment of this verse 13. But in Daniel's time, of course, the first attack and destruction of Jerusalem had already, and of the temple had already taken place by Nebuchadnezzar. But there was in front of Daniel in verse 15 someone in appearance like an able-bodied man, and he was identifying himself as Gabriel. Make that one there. It says, the voice of an earthling man called out and said, no, he identified, right. He said, Gabriel, make that one there understand the things seen. The earthling man said to Gabriel, now who's Gabriel? I didn't think we'd seen the name Gabriel yet in this chapter. I haven't read all of this chapter because I missed that Gabriel part. That's how I know I didn't read it all. But obviously I missed that. But when there was this, let's read this, the Holy One was speaking, how long will the vision be of the constant feature? Right? The Holy One was speaking. So the Holy One was probably, that was Gabriel. And the earthling man said, Gabriel, make that one there understand the thing seen. So he said, understand, Gabriel said, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. But he also said, the ram that you saw possessing the two horns stands for the kings of Media and Persia. And the hairy he-goat stands for the king of Greece. So it does stand for Greece, and that was what we saw. There were four horns that came up after him, and that's what happened with Alexander the Great. And he was the great king of Greece. So the kingdom of Alexander the Great was an immense empire, and so was, of course, so were the kings of the Medes and the Persians. But you see that the other thing is, very importantly, in chapter 7 of Daniel, we don't have time, we're out of time now. In chapter 7, though, we'll talk about this tomorrow. Look, it's again February 17th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 22:09 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you. It's been wonderful to be with you. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.